Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, good afternoon to everyone, and I am delighted to be performing for you here today in Dallas. Let me say first of all where I come from, sort of before I talk about the book itself, give you a sense of sort of what motivates the context behind which I wrote it. I'm a political scientist, right? I run a political risk firm. I'm not an economist. I'm not a strategist. So despite the suit, despite the New York, despite the people you've seated me with at the head table, if you ask me what Bernanke's going to do with rates in the next 6 months, right, I have no idea. And I won't tell you. I won't answer that question. On the other hand, if you ask an economist or chief global strategist on Wall Street what's going to happen in Iran with uranium enrichment over the next 3-6 months, right, they have no idea. But they will tell you. And the reason they will tell you is because there are no political scientists on Wall Street, right? I mean, there are plenty of even physicists, because chaos theory is useful for derivatives modeling. But you don't find political scientists. And when I was an academic at the ripe age of 24 at Stanford, I had no business teaching anything at that point. What I really wanted to do was try to understand how to make politics relevant to the markets and vice versa. And that was the field of political risk, which was very nascent at that point. That's really what motivates me. That's the way I think of the world. How do you think about political risk? At the time, it was very clear to me that politics were going to matter more to the global markets over time. This was sort of 1996, 1997. And I thought that that was true for a number of reasons that were drivers, basic drivers. They weren't variables. They weren't things that might or might not happen. They were basic drivers. One, very obvious, especially right here in Dallas, is that energy is increasingly coming from parts of the world that are very unstable and opaque. Right? It's the Persian Gulf. It's the Caspian. It's West Africa. Secondly, dangerous technologies are becoming increasingly diffuse. So rogue states, rogue organizations, even rogue individuals increasingly pose a threat to global stability. And I'm not just talking about North Korea. I'm talking about the ability of Hezbollah to launch missiles far deeper into Israeli territory. What happens when they can actually hit Tel Aviv in a few years and local Israeli bankers have to be in safe houses for a few hours at a time? I'm talking about the Madrid bombings on 3/11. And those terrorists, I think you had Lawrence Wright here recently, those terrorists had no terrorist background, had no contacts with Al-Qaeda, didn't know each other 6 months beforehand, and the money that they used didn't come from outside sources. It came from drug dealing locally. I mean, if I had been interviewing for terrorists out of Eurasia Group, they wouldn't have made it past my first screen. But when the attacks occurred, everyone believed that it had hallmark Al-Qaeda. So that's a driver. That's going to get worse over time. That's going to make politics matter more to the global markets and to all of us. Thirdly, the rise of China, right? I mean, the fact that the global economy is increasingly determined by a country that is much more opaque, for which politics is a much greater driver than economic decision-making for whether or not China ultimately succeeds or fails. It's not like doing business in the United States or the Czech Republic or France or Great Britain. And fourth, and probably most important because it's so structural, is the world is moving from a U.S.-led unipolar system to a more multipolar system with a multiplicity of actors. And I'm not trying to argue that that's good or bad. The markets are agnostic about this stuff, but it's a reality. And it's moving with an international architecture that's been created to deal with a system that has nothing like the geopolitics of today's world, whether you're looking at the UN Security Council or whether you're looking at the G8 or whether you're looking at NATO. There is no NATO or EU in Asia. despite the fact that China is growing at record pace, despite the fact that Japan is becoming a much more assertive international power. Those international institutions didn't exist. They didn't need to exist in 1945, but they need to exist today. But they won't exist until there's a very big shock. You see how impossible it is to reform the Security Council, and that shock would affect us. So, my bet is that international politics are going to matter more. They have mattered more for the last 10 years. They're going to matter more for the next 10 years. There are things that would make them matter less, new technology for energy, for example, but that's not a 5 to 10 year phenomenon. Okay, so if you buy that, then I've proven to you in my first 5 minutes that I am both potentially interesting and potentially relevant, right? What I have not done is proven to any of you that I am potentially actionable. And to move from being a political scientist to running a political risk firm, you actually have to be actionable. And that's what political risk is all about. So what do I mean by political risk? Political risk is how politics sort of affect outcomes on the ground in countries all over the world. You can be a U.S. policymaker, you can be a corporation, you can be an individual investor, you have a contract, you have a treaty, you have an agreement. To what extent is that going to continue to hold place? There are two things you need to understand if you want to get at political risk. The first is instability, and the second is shock. If you have a situation that is unstable and a shock hits, you have political risk. Shock is hard to measure, right? It's hard to get your hands around, because a shock can be anything. Shock can be a tsunami off the coast of Indonesia. Shock can be an earthquake in Kashmir. A shock can be the sudden assassination of the leader of a political party. The shock can be the sudden discovery of a cassette tape that says that the prime minister of a country lied to the people in the morning and lied to the people in the evening. Now, of course, that last instance I'm talking just happened in Hungary. But the problem is that no one knew that that tape existed until it came up. So we're very hard often to model or be predictive about these shocks. Stability, on the other hand, you can get a pretty good handle on. And that's the key, in my view, and that's sort of why the J-curve exists for me. That's why I wrote it. Let me give you an example of stability. And I will try this out on John Stewart if it works here. I want you to imagine, right? I said I've just started this. This is not my day job, talking about my books, so this is all learning curve for me. Imagine for a second, do a little thought experiment with the audience here, and this is unfair because I'm in Texas, but I want you to imagine that there is an election for a head of state, right? And the outcome of that election is considered fraudulent by a majority of the population, okay? I want you to just imagine that anywhere in the world. And I want you to further imagine that the eventual outcome of that election is determined by what is thought to be a partisan decision of the top judicial organ in that land, okay? Anywhere in the world, just imagine that, right? And I mean, I see that you're laughing, and of course you all realize that this just happened in Mexico. And it also happened in Ukraine with the Orange Revolution. It also happened in Taiwan with Mr. Chen. And of course it also happened in the United States in 2000. Now, I don't care if you thought Bush or Gore deserved to win that election. Again, I really don't care. But I remember after that election, a number of friends of mine from Indonesia, and from Turkey and from Russia called me up and they said, Ian, you guys, you Americans, you're such hypocrites. You talk about exporting democracy and your values all over the world, and look at what you do in your own country. And I said, you miss the point. It is precisely the fact that you can have that kind of political crisis with no social instability, with no impact to America's credit rating, with no impact to foreign direct investment in the United States. The same thing happens in your countries. There are flames in the streets. Stability. Right? The same thing did happen in Ukraine. There was an Orange Revolution that was then overturned, and they are still in crisis. Same thing happened in Taiwan. Markets down 7.5%. The next day had to close them. Same thing happens in Mexico. Right? Now, AMLO has declared himself president. Okay. He says that he's going to collect taxes. Talk about double taxation in Mexico, right? This is an issue in Mexico. But the peso hasn't moved. Particularly, foreign direct investment hasn't really come off. And what I think is interesting is that, right, there's a middle class that functions in Mexico. It's emergent, but it's there. there's a rule of law in Mexico that has a level of cohesion. There's a bureaucracy that functions. I think AMLO has actually isolated himself by taking the steps that he has. A lot of people in Mexico think the election was stolen. A lot of people in Mexico believe Obrador should be president, but they're not prepared to hawk the country for it. And I think we're going to look back on Mexico in 12 months' time and see that this unfortunate political episode actually proves to us that they're much more like the United States than they are like, say, Ukraine. And that's a good thing. So, stability matters. Okay? And if you can get your hands around why a country might or might not be stable, and you show the direction that country is moving in, you can determine an awful lot. Okay? So that's the big wind-up for the J-curve. So what is the J-curve? The J-curve tries to understand why countries are and aren't stable, what motivates them. And here's the point. I'm going to give you the J-curve in 2 minutes. Explain it. Right? Some countries are stable because they're open. The United States, France, Great Britain, Japan. Some countries are stable because they're closed. North Korea, Iraq under Hussein, Cuba, Burma, Turkmenistan. Right? The relationship between a country's openness, both internationally in terms of foreign direct investment and internet and human transit and migration, but also internally in terms of the ability to share information and ideas and talk with other citizens in an unfettered way within a country, the relationship between openness and stability follows the shape of a J. The curve is steeper on the left than it is on the right. Because if you are a failed state and you want to suddenly create stability, it is much faster to do that if you declare martial law and close the country than it is to build an open and free society and civil institutions. Also, the curve is higher on the right, ultimately, than it is on the left, because if you go the openness and civil institutions right, ultimately you will build a much stronger society, a much more stable society, than you will if you go the authoritarian route. Hence, things like Ceausescu in Romania, right? Final point, the entire curve moves up or down on the basis of how much economic resources you have available to yourself. So if they suddenly strike Earl in North Korea, the whole curve goes up. Saudi Arabia, prices go from 20 to 65 bucks a barrel, curve goes up everywhere along the curve. China, growth goes to 11% every year for God knows how many, curve goes up. Okay. This should make intuitive sense, right? A lot of what I'm saying, I see some nods around the table. I mean, I can explain this relatively simply. If it's true, if it's even close to true, it has some fairly dramatic implications for how policies will and won't work and how investments will and won't work. Let me give you a few examples. First, when the United States says that they wish to punish rogue regimes for misbehavior by isolating them, that actually plays into what these countries are trying to do to maintain power, right? I'm not suggesting, again, that this is a bad or a good idea, right? Maintaining stability in North Korea has upsides and downsides. Destabilizing North Korea has upsides and downsides. But if your intention is regime change in North Korea, and that is the present U.S. policy, what you should be doing is trying to open it. You should not be isolating it. Now, how can you open a country that doesn't want to be open? Well, South Koreans had one idea. South Korean dissidents wanted to send a couple thousand solar-powered radios across the border by helium balloon across the DMZ and allow the North Korean citizens to listen to it. And the South Korean government thought that would be too provocative. They didn't do it. You're right. It would be very provocative. But it would destabilize the country. You know, Chinese free trade zones that the Chinese government has tried on occasion to set up in North Korea, those would be a positive thing for trying to destabilize the country. Now, should we or should we not be destabilizing North Korea? Well, if you don't destabilize North Korea, they do engage in human trafficking, drug trafficking, trafficking of ballistic missile componentry. Over time, one would expect they will engage in trafficking of nuclear material and technology. That is very bad globally. On the other hand, if you destabilize North Korea, there's a chance that they'll react, right, with a nuclear test. There's a chance that they'll react, you know, more aggressively in terms of hassling maritime traffic in the region. If they do that, the Japanese are likely to build up their military capacity. We can talk about that when we talk about China. If the North Korean regime falls apart, the cost of reunification would clearly be minimum five times the cost of East-West German reunification. South Koreans couldn't pay for that. And then you'd also have millions of people streaming across the border into China, refugees. So you tell me which of those you want. My point is, J-curve touched how to get there. Okay? North Korea is kind of easy because it's obvious. I mean, Cuba, right? I mean, there's a reason why Castro has been in power for 47 years. There's a reason why when the Clinton administration tried to reduce sanctions somewhat, the Cuban government's response was to shoot down a civilian aircraft. And then we saw the Helms-Burton Act, and that was the end of that. The Cuban government doesn't want sanctions gotten rid of. It allows them to have much more control domestically. That's useful from the Cuban government's perspective. Saddam Hussein, supposedly building up weapons of mass destruction. International community says, we've got sanctions on you, oil for food sanctions. We will get rid of them or reduce them if you just open up and show us you don't have WMD. He refuses to do it consistently. We now know he didn't have those weapons of mass destruction. Okay, why didn't Hussein cooperate? Because the sanctions were useful. They allowed him to control all the money that was coming into that country. You get rid of those sanctions, he's going to have difficulty. It doesn't mean they don't want to be paid off. North Korea would be happy to, you know, be extortionate with nuclear weapons and take cash as a consequence, but they don't want investment. They don't want tourism. They don't want U.S. direct diplomatic relations. Don't want an embassy on the ground. Certainly don't want inspectors running around North Korea, potentially picking up information and defectors from the country. Okay? So that's the far left of the curve. Let's talk about a couple other places. If I'm saying that the U.S. is getting North Korea wrong and Cuba wrong, one thing they're getting right is China. A lot of people will tell me when I talk about North Korea, well, what are you suggesting? That the U.S. has a country that's doing something it doesn't like, has a regime it considers odious, and we welcome our arms to them? That is the China strategy, right? I mean, the Chinese government is considered odious. It's a communist state, massive human rights violator. And yet the U.S. strategy has been do everything possible to bring these guys into the international community, invest as much as possible, with the hope that reforms will go so fast that the Chinese government won't be able to maintain its present system. That's a pretty good strategy, actually. Might work. Couple things about that strategy. First, the U.S. government has a hedging strategy. If it doesn't work, where else has Bush been incredibly effective? Japan, best relations the U.S. had with Japan decades. India, also great relations. The recognition, and the Japanese and the Indians share this recognition, that if things don't go well with China, you need to hedge. You need to have another strategy. You can't put all of your eggs in the China basket. I find it fascinating that the U.S. government gets this and most American multinationals don't. Right? You look at GM or Walmart and you look at corporations that are singularly focusing their multinational growth strategy on China exposure. When the investment climate to China is difficult, to say the best, here's what China, I think, is doing. Right? I think the Chinese government recognizes that, you know, opening the country up towards globalization is moving the curve up, but it's also making the country more unstable. And so can you move it up fast enough that you can get through the dip of the curve and sort of maintain your country, maintain the strategy? Maybe they can. Economists think they can. Maybe they can't. I personally am not so sure. But I'll tell you one thing. What you can't do is afford for Chinese growth to suddenly go from 11 to 2, right? Because if you suddenly slow that growth down significantly, the level of social instability in that country is going to be massive. And the problem is that there are a number of fat tails that I can think of that would make China much more susceptible to 2% growth. I mean, the economists will talk about real estate bubble in China, financial crisis, banking crisis in China. I'm not going to argue. I'm not an economist. A political scientist, I just mentioned possibility of an underground North Korean nuclear test. Okay? If they do that, the Japanese are going to respond with Prime Minister Abe, change the constitution quickly, and dramatically ramp up their defensive and offensive capabilities militarily vis-a-vis the North Koreans. It'll be incredibly popular within Japan and within the LDP. If they do that, the Chinese, I suspect, are going to see much greater anti-Japanese demonstrations throughout the country than we saw a year ago in May. That has the possibility of severely queering Japan-China economic relations, which would impact Chinese growth. Another possibility, Iran, gets worse. And ultimately, we see surgical strikes by the U.S. and or Israel. Oil pops to 120. That's going to bring Chinese growth from 11 to 2. Or worse. Another possibility, avian flu. Right? We now know just from last month, there was a United Nations health report that showed that the new strains that have been seen to be transmitted of avian flu in Indonesia from human to human are actually the same as came originally from China. Right? The Chinese government has been completely opaque and not cooperated well with the World Health Organization. What happens if the WHO finds that there has been larger amounts of human-to-human transmission? Doesn't have to be very virulent, doesn't have to kill many people, only has to increase the threat level from 3 to 4, and then you have travel restrictions on China. That would bring Chinese growth from 11 to 2. I am not suggesting any of these things are 50% likely, but you'd be hard-pressed for me to argue that they're not at least 10% likely each in the next year or two. I got to tell you, you know, that's a major downside risk that I think the U.S. government is right to hedge. Surprises me again that multinationals aren't doing it. In fact, let me say something particularly provocative on China. If I had been the Chinese government, I never would have bid for the Olympics in 2008. I think it's a mistake. I look back on the Atlanta Olympics in the United States. They're pretty good Olympics. What do people remember about the Atlanta Olympics? Bomb. You know, I mean, everyone's going to be focused on China for an entire month. And the Chinese government will do a great job in trying to set up a Potemkin village to do nothing but show the best side. But, you know, there are a lot of people in China that are not happy with this Chinese government. Right? I don't even just mean the Falun Gong. I mean disenfranchised journalists. I mean sort of, you know, peasants that have been kicked off their land because of, you know, water reclamation projects, because of, you know, massive issues with infrastructure building. It's very different from India where, you know, infrastructure is, you know, built very slowly because you have to get everybody bought in locally. In China, no problem, move the village. You can do it, and it's great until it isn't. So, I mean, what is the chances of another Tiananmen-style type episode in Beijing 2008, given all of that percolating? And how much do you need before the response internationally is that Beijing 2008 was not a great idea, but boy, this is more dangerous than we thought it was, especially in the context of U.S. protectionist tropes, which exist, for example, with Senator Schumer and others. I'm very concerned about that. So I throw that out there. Let me talk about a few other places, and then I'll open it up to questions. Iran. I'm obviously worried about Iran. I think what we need to understand is that if we were to look at the Middle East over the last 20 years, and you were to ask me, what are the countries that are most open in the Middle East in terms of treatment of minorities, in terms of women's rights, in terms of openness of the media, in terms of competence of local judges, in terms of NGOs on the ground. Number one is clearly Israel. Clearly. Number two is Lebanon. Number three, until quite recently, is probably Iran. Right? President Ahmadinejad had a press conference 2 weeks ago. And he talked about the Holocaust and everybody applauds. He talks about nuclear rights and everybody applauds. He talked about the economy. He got hammered by his own Iranian media. Right? There are a lot of people inside Iran that are not happy with this government. And the Iranian government in place knows that the best way for them to ensure that they stay in power is to get rid of the reformists, it's to close down the media, it's to throw all of the would-be independents out of the key religious councils, out of the universities, and they've been trying very hard to do that. But how do you do that? You've got to keep oil prices high, and you've got to try to provoke a conflict with the international community on the nuclear issue. Right? I mean, punitive measures that are relatively ineffectual, taken by the United States and Europe, and maybe even China, against Iran, plays into that strategy. So let me throw something crazy out at you. Bush administration, best strategy right now, especially in the run-up to elections, might well be do everything you can to talk down the crisis. Get oil prices down. Get the Saudis to help you, because they don't want, you know, the Iranians to have nuclear weapons either. Now, I don't believe I'm saying get oil prices down in Dallas. That is a scary thing to do. But in terms of Iran, right, in terms of Iran, I think that's probably the best short-term strategy. Keep the diplomacy going, knowing it's probably not going to work. Spend as much as you can covertly to try to support opposition, not overtly. You don't want not $75 million that's, you know, earmarked to help Iranian opposition will only identify those people as tied to the U.S. and hurt them locally, but covertly. Do everything you can to see over the next 1 year, 18 months, can you destabilize this government, get something better in place? If you can't and they still are building their nukes and diplomacy doesn't work, fine, you can blow them up, right? Because the Israelis will anyway. If it doesn't work, the military option, unfortunately, capitulation, I mean, I saw an article today by Ted Koppel saying let them have nukes, basically, but if they do anything, we're coming after you. That's great if Israel doesn't exist. The Israeli government, no way, will allow the Iranian government to have nuclear weapons. Other countries in the region will develop them. For the Israelis, this is a question of national survival. It is not just a question of national interest. And also, Olmert will probably be gone within 6 to 12 months. Netanyahu will probably replace him. There is no way you can do the North Korea capitulation option that the U.S. has effectively taken with North Korea and Iran. You can't do it. Okay? So, you know, my view, and the good thing about my strategy is that even if it's wrong, gas prices come down, hey, that helps Bush. Right? So, I mean, you know, you're playing it both ways. I'm probably going to write an op-ed on this because I think it's just nuts not to. Last couple points. Iraq. We know that it is relatively easy for the United States to help countries get from the top left of the curve down to the bottom. And that happened in the Soviet Union. It happened in Afghanistan. It happened in Iraq. Getting those countries to the right of the curve requires an immense amount of money and commitment and security. The international community is showing, and NATO is showing, they are not prepared to spend that on the ground in Afghanistan. The U.S. public and the British public have shown that they are not prepared to spend that kind of capital on the ground in Iraq. Now, if you are not prepared to spend that for 10 years or more in Iraq, and we're not, right, and that would be the best option, and obviously expectations were set way too high by everybody for what was going to happen in Iraq, but if you can't get there, then the best options are fall off the curve or go back to the left. In other words, elections, probably bad idea in Iraq, with the exception of the Kurdish area, if you're not going to keep the troops on the ground for the long haul, right? Because that will just help the country fall apart. What you need then is a strong hand. Give up on democracy, right? And I think that's where we are. Final point. The United States is on the top of the curve. France is. Great Britain is. The great thing about being on the top of the curve is you can screw up a lot and it doesn't matter that much, right? You can keep your stability. Is there anything that could start to move the U.S. down the curve? There's not much, but there's one thing I worry about. Right? When 9/11 hit in the United States, the response was incredibly unifying within the U.S. It was incredibly unifying around the world, and there was a clear external target. If 9/11 were to happen again in the U.S., God forbid, I fear it would be far more polarizing. There'd be tremendous finger-pointing in terms of, it was Iraq, war on terror, who was supposed to be watching all of this? We need tougher measures for homeland security. I think you wouldn't get the international support, there clearly wouldn't be an obvious singular enemy externally, and there'd be a lot more focus on things like protectionism and homeland security from both the right and the left. This is the Lou Dobbs and the Pat Buchanan groups, right? And that, of course, long-term could start to bring the U.S. down the curve somewhat. In Europe, I'm more concerned than I am in the United States because of the nature of the Islamic populations within that country and the rise of the hard right in a number of countries there. I mean, we see what's happened to Danish exports, down 28%, 6 months after the anti-Muhammad cartoon incident. You know, we see the reactions that we're getting in the region. I am concerned that over time this is going to completely derail the Turkish EU accession process. And Lord knows the Europeans need that labor if they want to continue to grow economically. Again, over time, I am concerned that you will see the victory of a strongly anti-immigrant party, either by itself or as part of a coalition, in one or more European states. And that, over time, could start to delegitimize some of those institutions as significant portions of the populations find that those countries are no longer representing them. That could start to, over time, bring those countries down. Let me end on a positive note, though. I mean, and two positive notes. The first is that there is real strength in the U.S. and Europe. You know, it took not just decades, it took centuries to build the institutions that create the stability we have today, and that's not going to be torn apart by Bush or by Clinton or by, I'm right, I mean, it's ridiculous to think it will. That's the first point. And the second point, though, is that there have been some real successes around the world. And I talk about Mexico, but I was just in Brazil. We've got elections going on today. Lula's probably going to win, did well in the first round, going to go to a second round. I look at Thailand, the coup we just had there, and they're moving quite quickly to what will be another round to democratic elections, and the king's behind it. But there's a relatively transparent process now. I see, you know, there are a lot of countries in the world, East Europe as well, where they've gotten through the dip, and they've built India, they've built some stability, and they're moving. And emerging markets, in many cases, have emerged and will become investment grade, and that's a great thing. And the real question is, can you get China there? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm somewhat skeptical, but I think the U.S. has the best strategy for it. So anyway, if you guys can tell if I'm a Dem or Republican at the end of this, you should never talk to me. Seriously, I really enjoyed being here. I'm looking forward to your questions, and thank you very much. The question was, can I comment on Paulson's recent trip to China, how well I think it's gone, and sort of strategy going forward? I think it is not a surprise, right, that one of the places that I think the Bush administration has done the best job has been a part of the world where the portfolio has been handled by a group of individuals that understand not just American strategic imperatives, but also economics, right? That's not just the case with Paulson. It's true of Mr. Zelik. It's true of Mr. Portman, all of whom have handled China. I mean, I remember when I was briefing a White House group on North Korea about 2-3 years ago, and they knew more about North Korea than anyone in the country, this group. And we were talking about all these scenarios and so forth, and one of them said, well, you know, it wouldn't be such a bad thing if North Korea tested a nuclear weapon, because then the Chinese would get behind the U.S. And they came up with scenarios. Nobody talked about the markets. And I said, well, but aren't you worried about what would you do when the South Korean market collapses? And they sort of all looked at me for a while. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, there's hot money in South Korea, and all of it from the hedge funds believes that there's no possibility of a nuclear test because it's all stable now. So when that happens, you're talking about 30-50%, I would say, overnight crash, right? What do you do? And they said something which scared me somewhat. They said, could you write us a memo on that? And I did. But on China, you don't have Paulson asking for memos like that. Paulson's been there 30 times. He understands the system. He was received at the highest possible level in China. They talked about a strategic economic dialogue. Look, I'd say a couple things. I think one, you know, Paulson has now bought some time in Congress to get rid of all of these, you know, sort of protectionist issues and CFIUS and everything else. And that's good. But that's going to come back. He's got a honeymoon. But he's going to be given 6-12 months to get something done where the Chinese have to sort of give on, you know, the currency. And give on intellectual property issues. And they may or may not. And if they don't, it's going to come back and bite them. Because expectations in Congress for China are now higher because of Paulson's trip. So you got to recognize that. Having said that, you may have seen that the head of the Shanghai Communist Party last Monday was ousted, which is the single biggest internal shakeup in the Communist Party in 10 years. Now, a lot of people are saying this is bad news, because the Shanghai faction is more pro-market and pro-growth. That's true, except for the fact that in the last several years, the Chinese political system has been so bunged up by both groups whacking each other, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao in Beijing, and the Shanghai faction in Shanghai after Jiang Zemin is sort of out, that they haven't been able to do anything. And so my optimistic scenario for China in the near term, and I think Paulson will be successful, I do, is because I think this is like Turkey. When Erdogan won as prime minister in Turkey, everyone said, boy, this guy is much worse for reforms than people like Ecevit. True. But suddenly, Turkey was no longer this fragmented coalition government that no one could do anything. The AK party had a majority in Turkey. And wouldn't you know it, they ended up doing, you know, moving on reforms. And I think the ability to move now in China exists. They're not going to move as far as perhaps some of the people in Shanghai would have wanted, but they will be able to move. And I think that's going to surprise some people. So short term, I mean, I'm real concerned about Beijing, 2008, but short term, I actually think this is going to work out pretty well. Pretty positive, yeah. Yeah, my problem with India, I mean, I think that, oh, I'm sorry. The point was that, you know, India's workforce is going to grow a lot faster than China's. China has a major demographic issue looming because of the, you know, sort of the detritus of the one-child policy and so forth. And do I think, I mean, India's China has much better infrastructure, he said, and it's true. And do we? I get to agree or disagree with the question as I repeat it. And so, do I think India is going to start attracting major foreign direct investment? Look, my first point: China's risky. Okay, China's riskier. The downside, the upside in China is great. The downside is greater than people think. So you should be hedging China. Should you be hedging China with India, not by itself, because India is hard to invest in? Southeast Asia will do better, I think, than India will in terms of the pickup of a lot of the China hedges. Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, Cambodia even, Vietnam. Why? Well, you know, the Indian technology sector has about 2 million of the best educated Indians that are out there to work for anyone in the world. And they're expensive. Okay? You get below those 2 million, and the Indian education system is god-awful. I mean, we're talking complete illiteracy for about half of the population. But I mean, even the top 10% is not very good. They're not competitive with China or with Russia. And it's not because India has a surfeit of democracy. It's because India has a surfeit of decentralization. So all of these local guys, you know, sort of do whatever they want. I mean, Indian infrastructure. Let me give an example. I was in India a few months ago, and I was talking to a couple of local ministers there, and the CEO of the head of the bank that does most of the mortgages and loans for roads. And he said that they're giving out the loans for roads at 50-kilometer sections a time. That's when they're doing across the entire country, 50-kilometer sections. Why? Because every local guy has to have the right to employ their people. Doesn't matter if they're effective. Doesn't matter when they finish it. That's the way it has to get done. The educational system is the same story. Everyone gets to do their own local curriculum. Everyone gets to determine how they're going to educate. It's god-awful. And a lot of the major players that are now investing in India are setting up their own educational training institutes locally. But not many people want to do that. It takes money. It's a pain. And you've got all these local regulatory issues. In Beijing, you can get crushed. But you also only have to set up your relations really in the central government, like in Moscow, right? In India, Delhi can tell you whatever they want. If you're Honda and you're in a local place, you don't have your locals taken care of. It's another hoop to go through. So, look, I think the downside in India is small. There's no chance of a big India-Pakistan fight coming out in the near future. They are picking up an infrastructure. They're just privatizing their airports. They're building ports faster than people would expect. But it's going to be hard for them to break out beyond the IT sector. And one final point on this is, last time I was there, I met with the heads of Tata Group, one of the biggest Indian conglomerates. And they were, I guess, looking at me as an investor, because they were talking about how great Tata is as opposed to India. And one of the things they said that made Tata investable is the fact that in the next 5-10 years, they have great plans for expanding their workforce deeply into East Central Europe and Southeast Asia, because they knew that Indian cost of employment was going to go up too much. They're going to go to East Central Europe because Indian labor is too expensive. The local CEO of Citigroup in India said that they have 30% turnover every year because they can't keep their best people. Infosys is having massive problems on the ground. So I'm really worried, not that India is going to fall apart, but the people that are expecting this massive growth in the Indian economy, you know, in sectors outside the super sexy tiny percent of the population are going to be disappointed. It doesn't have the near-term upside pop that everyone has been really hoping for the last few years. Question on the Central European states and the impact that they're going to have over the next few years. Well, I mean, I think that there are two points. There's Central Europe and there's Southeast Europe. And I think we need to recognize that Central Europe, even with the problems that Hungary and Poland are presently experiencing, the fact is that their infrastructure is, you know, at near West European levels right now, especially if you include countries like Portugal. And, you know, the costs of investing are about at European levels, too. One of the great things about the EU is that there's such an extraordinary amount of, you know, sort of regulatory hoops you have to go through, legal infrastructure you have to create and all of that, that, you know, the EU is one of the biggest magnets ever been created in the world to bring countries up the J-curve. And one of the reasons, if you're the U.S., you should really want Turkey to get into the EU is because you don't want Turkey to fall apart. You don't want, you know, sort of the Islamists to start to, you know, sort of have more wiggle room because the Turkish economy falls apart and therefore people go to a more populist message. But in terms, so the places that I'm more excited about from a business perspective would be Bulgaria, right, where, you know, they're just, you know, sort of they're on the second track of EU accession, and they're going to get it, and they're going to get all the benefits, but the costs are still low, and the relative investment is still small. You look at that American faucet company, it's not called that, but the biggest faucet manufacturer in the United States? No, not Kohler. American, it's like American Plumbing, I think it's called. American Standard, thank you. American Standard. American Standard is doing extraordinarily well in Bulgaria right now. And their cost of entry was near nothing, but they got in early, they developed their relationships, and now they're benefiting because, you know, they're taking advantage of infrastructure as it's getting built. They're taking advantage of a clearer legal structure that's coming online that they certainly didn't have when they came in at the equivalent of 30 cents on the dollar. News Corporation, BTV, it's their most successful single country unit in terms of revenues per dollar invested of anywhere in the world. That's pretty cool. And they haven't been shaken down by anyone. Romania is still a little too corrupt. They need to get a little further up the curve. Some of the Balkans as well. You know, Macedonia, I'm kind of excited. It's a tiny market, but I think they look pretty good. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's just not that much fundamental instability that's going to roil these countries going forward. Even Hungary, we'll get through this. The currencies, I mean, if you're a fixed income investor, it's a problem. But in terms of U.S. foreign policy, in terms of, you know, so the strength of the institutional relationships, the nature of their treaties, the support that they give internationally, they're on a good path. Yeah, well, the question is to what extent, I mean, if we look at terrorist organizations, you know, we reckon, especially with suicide bombers, which I didn't talk about, the mentality or mindset of suicide bombers is, you know, sort of how do we stop it? And to what extent can we be optimistic that we will be able to ultimately stop them, because historically we always have. Look, I think we have to recognize that the fat tails are growing, okay? I don't even mean just through terrorism. Are any of you familiar with the Brookhaven experiments that have been going on? Very interesting. I'm going to depart into sort of quantum theory for a second. Martin Rees, the astronomer, the royal astronomer out of Cambridge University, has been working with these guys at these laboratory, they're doing these experiments that try to replicate the sort of microsecond after the Big Bang on a tiny, tiny scale, but enormous amounts of pressure, you know, and they've done the math. And they believe that there is something like a 1 in 500 million chance that, you know, they'll create a chain reaction that would blow up the world, the entire world. Now, I mean, you know, 1 in 500 million, pretty small. They've got funding. Nobody's been really overseeing them in terms of governments and so forth. They've done about 10 of these experiments. 1 in 500 million, 6 billion people on the planet. So on average, every time you run the experiment, 12 people die. Okay, it's funny math, but my point is that you now have, even just through experiments, the ability for, you know, sort of really massive calamitous negative, you know, consequences on the basis of something going wrong. Ill-intentioned individuals will be able to do much more damage. I'm very concerned that a dirty bomb, you know, that doesn't kill many people, but could cause mass panic and completely overtax the public health system of a major city, could collapse an economy. I'm concerned about that. I'm especially concerned in a place like Moscow, where, you know, you have large amounts of scientists that don't have jobs, you have large amounts of radiological material that's unaccounted for, and you have an indigenous terrorist organization right there expanding in terms of the Chechens. Now, do we ultimately win? Sure, I'm an optimist. I'm also a young guy. Yeah, I think we also. I'm delighted that I'm here. I don't understand why I am, but I'm delighted that I exist. You know, so everything else is, you know, sort of gravy from that perspective. I mean, seriously, philosophically, that's my philosophy. I think every morning we should be thankful for that sort of thing. But I don't think I've ever said that publicly. But it's true. Nobody ever asked me about the philosophy of terrorism. But in terms of, you know, when I look at the National Intelligence Council. And I've helped them now, my company's helped them for the last sort of 5 years in terms of looking at scenarios long term. Every 5 years they do scenarios for what the world will look like out in 15 years. And I'll tell you, the range of scenarios in today's compared to the range 5 years ago is far greater, right? The volatility, the ability for it to be very nasty. And I mean, ultimately, the questions that you and I are dealing with on a daily basis in terms of our lives, who we want to vote for, in terms of our businesses, they're not determined by whether the good guy ultimately wins. They're determined by what kind of shocks we're going to have to deal with tomorrow for our kids, for our education, for everything else. And in that regard, you know, I think we're in for, if I were really making market calls, I'd be long volatility, right? Because that's what I see.
And I think the downside, unfortunately, is getting greater. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, the question was, you know, given the J-curve and the effectiveness or not of sanctions historically, how do I view the U.S. approach towards Chavez? Well, look, Chavez was just, you know, in the States, and he gave this nice speech at the U.N., calling Bush the devil. You know, if he was trying to play well in the United States, the fact that Pelosi and Rangel both came out afterwards and supported Bush, I mean, you don't get that very often. So that didn't work. If he's trying to get a permanent seat on the Security Council, I think he probably hurt his cause somewhat. I still think he has the inside track compared to Guatemala, but there will be a few countries that will now think maybe this guy is just a nut job and we don't want him there. But it's all talk, you know? I mean, everyone's talking about Venezuela being such a threat to the U.S., and everyone's been concerned that he's going to go and nationalize all this stuff within his country. And you know what he's looking at nationalizing right now? It's a golf course in Caracas. And why? Because, you know, it's a sign of, you know, sort of wealth and exploitative elites and all of this. And, I mean, it is true that the quality of golf in Caracas is likely to go down. And I am worried about that because I have financial clients that go there. But I also think that, you know, at the end of the day, the Venezuelans need to sell the U.S. energy. They need to sell the U.S. oil, and my understanding is that the quality of that oil is unrefinable in China. They don't have the capacity. And the U.S. wants to buy it. Well, that works pretty well. You know, if you want to get rid of Chavez, again, from my perspective, you want to have, you know, sort of stronger diplomatic relations. You want to have people on the ground that are able to sort of, you know, get a better sense of what's happening there, who are the potential folks that might be opposed to Chavez, what sort of scenario. You want that information, right? And the more you can do to get there, fine. But in terms of the level of threat that I see from Venezuela, it's not great. And, you know, a lot of people were concerned there was going to be this anti-U.S. leftist coalition developing in Latin America. Well, obviously that hasn't happened in Mexico. It's not happening in Brazil. You know, Lula tried to strike out with Venezuela and said that we're going to build a great relationship with Mercosur. Well, Paraguay and Uruguay want out. Mercosur is almost a dead letter. Nobody, you know, the funny thing about Sao Paulo, you go to Sao Paulo, and you realize that foreign policy doesn't matter in Brazil. There are no Muslims on the ground. They don't care about Iraq. There's no war on terror. Most of them were educated in the United States. And they don't really care about Bush, right? I mean, the notion that, you know, that Lula was having fun with Chavez was considered blah, blah, blah in Brazil. Nobody supported it. And he's given up on it. If you look at his own platform today, he's not doing it. So, I mean, in general, yeah, the U.S. has probably ignored Latin America a little more than it should have over the last few years, understandably, given the nature of other things that are blowing up today. It's given how many political appointees the U.S. has as ambassadors, it would have been better if some of those people, if more of those people had actually come up from through the State Department ranks, because if you're not going to focus on it at a high level, you don't want some guy that doesn't actually understand how American politics works determining. I mean, America's ambassador to India has been a disaster for the last few years, a political appointee with no expertise at all, almost screwed up the U.S.-India relationship. But it was an important enough country that, you know, higher people got a hold of it. Some of the LATAM countries, you can get hurt that way. So, I mean, I think that's a structural problem in the U.S. that, say, Britain has gotten around. But the money talks, right? So, I mean, that's also important. And, I mean, you know, at some point I might want to be ambassador someplace. So, I mean, I shouldn't go too strongly against it. I'm somewhat serious about that. So anyway, that's my general view on Chavez. And please, all, you know, buy books, put reviews on Amazon. Wish me luck on Wednesday. You've been a great audience. Thank you all very, very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.